I have a theory, and I want to run it past you and tell me whether you think it makes sense. To me, it felt like, as an observer of podcasting, that podcasting reached a sort of a peak around 2005, 2006, something like that, when, you know, Ev Williams was thinking that Odeo was going to be his next startup, and there seemed to be a lot of momentum behind it. And then it felt like there was a bit of a lull, and I thought podcasting might be going the way of RSS, something that was going to be of interest to a nerdy, geeky subsection of the world, but maybe not quite as mainstream. But it feels like in the last year or so, there has been this revival of interest, and you see things like Dan Benjamin doing his 5x5 network, and the story that was in the New York Times about Mark Maron, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and the boom.
That's Maron.
Mark Maron, excuse me. Yeah, and the boom in comedy podcasts, and all the work that you've done. Basically, my theory is that we're seeing sort of a podcasting revival. Does that make sense, or was I sort of imagining the lull?
Certainly, at the very beginning, there was a lot of speculative money going, well, a modest amount of speculative money going into podcasting based on an audience that wasn't there yet. And I think those businesses have failed. I haven't typed odeo.com into my browser lately, but at some point they got sold to, like, you know, a Taiwanese shoe manufacturer or something. And certainly there were a number of years that were not 2005. Whether things changed dramatically this year, yes and no. I know that my numbers on all of my shows have basically had the same growth curve for the last 6-7 years now, since I started podcasting at the late 2004. And that is, they've all sort of increased in audience about 50% a year, which is a great growth rate, although not an exponential, crazy internet growth rate that you might see with a popular new web thing. And I sort of attribute that to the fact that listening to podcasts is still every bit as much of a hassle as it was 6 or 7 years ago. Now, the one place that I have seen things change is, you know, as you sort of alluded to, I'm kind of embedded in the comedy world here in Los Angeles, and especially the alternative comedy world. And there has been an explosion in comedy podcasting. I mean, 3 years ago, it was pretty much, you know, it was me and Never Not Funny with my friend Jimmy Pardo, and The Best Show on WFMU with my friend Tom Sharpling, and a couple of other shows. And I think that maybe the success of Adam Carolla and Kevin Smith led a lot of comedians to kind of get to the point where they thought it would be worth it to gain the technical skills to make a podcast, and a couple of entrepreneurs to decide to, you know, put together studios where comedians could come in and work for them for free. So there has been a bit of an explosion in terms of the talent, at least on the comedy side. And I think that is something that's changed in the past year or 18 months.
From your perspective, I mean, I think of comedians who, you know, maybe have a sitcom or have some other big media property that's their main paycheck, and they occasionally would go off to do some stand-up to sort of test out material, try new things, get recharged a little bit. Does the podcasting world in the comedy space fulfill a similar kind of role? What does a comedian get out of it? I mean, are the numbers big enough that if Robin Williams decides to go on a comedy podcast, he's going to be reaching a lot of people? Is it a creative space?
You know, it's a variety of things. I think stand-up comedians in particular are used to the idea of doing things that enhance their road pay. you know, a comedian inherently understands the relationship between going on The Tonight Show and then getting paid 25% more for the next year's worth of road gigs. And I think that podcasting, that makes podcasting make sense to comedians. They see that if they can reach people, that will enhance their reputation and their drawing ability on the road, which is, for many comedians, their main way to make money. Now, there are also comedians whose main way to make money is by making television or making films or some other form. For those comedians, I think that podcasting, at least in part, fulfills the same role as something like the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater here in Los Angeles, which is a theater where nobody gets paid, but lots of famous people perform and various levels of fame, because they need a place to work on stuff and they need a warm audience that will get what they're doing to, you know, develop what their work is. So I think it's a combination of those two things and different things for different people. But generally speaking, I think the key is that comedians are an audience that inherently understands that, you know, they have to do work for free to do work that they get paid for.
Mm-hmm. And is it still, I know that there are exceptions to this rule, but it seems from my observation of that scene that it hasn't been the name brand, the bigger name comedians who are launching or hosting the podcast, with the obvious exception of Adam Carolla. It seems like it's more that the producers of the shows are sort of separate from the guest talent who'll come by and, you know, and riff for 45 minutes on a topic or two.
There are tons of headlining stand-up comics that are doing podcasts these days. There aren't a lot of like theater headlining level stand-up comics that are doing that, but you know, there aren't a lot of theater level headlining stand-up comics out there. I mean, Joe Rogan has a podcast. He's not that far from that level, having hosted Fear Factor and so forth, and having been on news radio and everything. Most of the comedians who are doing podcasts are accomplished professional comedians who can go to, you know, often go, you know, Paul F. Tompkins, for example, can go to Philadelphia and headline a big club for a long weekend, but he can't go to Philadelphia and play, you know, where the 76ers play.
As now, you've all your main radio product, I suppose, if we're going to put it in that way, is the Sound of Young America. You always had Jordan Jesse Go on as well, but you had an interview show as opposed to the kind of comedy space that we've been describing. Now, obviously, you interview lots of comedians, but do you think that the comedy approach, the comedy format, the comedy space works better for podcasting than interviews? Or do you feel like the interview, you know, which is sort of a classic radio form, of course, still transfers over pretty well comparatively?
Well, there's not a lot of interviews on the radio. I mean, outside of public radio, the kind of interviews that I do on The Sound of Young America are relatively rarely heard. I definitely think that there was a really big untapped audience for comedy on the radio. Every other country in the world, there's a lot of comedy on the radio. And here, the only thing that there really is the kind of morning zoo format. And outside of a few people, that's generally calling it comedy is a very loose description. And I think that because of the way that that is produced, because it's locally produced, rather than being produced in New York and Los Angeles, where all the talent is, it sort of draws from a different, generally less talented talent pool than television and film do. And so, you know, it's a rough scene on the radio, but people enjoy listening to things and laughing at them. I mean, if you look at on public radio, for example, if you look at the success of Car Talk and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, these are shows that draw audiences literally in the millions, which is more than many networks' sitcoms at this point. And, you know, I think that the podcasting is filling in that niche that radio wasn't and isn't providing.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about The Sound of Young America and how it has expanded from being one part of, from being the main thing that you do from a public perception point of view, to being one part of an entire network of things, whether that's the other podcast that you've brought in, your other work, and that we'll get to a little bit later, we put this on, and television. Do you think from a business point of view that there's a lot of value to be gained from bringing in multiple podcasts into a network the way that, as I mentioned, Dan Benjamin's doing, the way that you're doing? What's the benefit of doing that?
There are a couple of benefits. I think in my case, my model is primarily donation-based. So in order to make any money, I have to be presenting a convincing case to people that this is so good that not only should they listen to it, but they should also send in money that they don't have to send in. I mean, I'm not even a nonprofit. The people don't even get a tax break. You know, they're just doing it because they want to support something that they like. And I think when I started Jordan Jesse Go, even, which was now, I guess, 4 years ago or something like that, part of the idea was that it would allow for a more personal connection and just a little bit of extra, almost fan service, although now it's as every bit as popular as The Sound of Young America, but just something that people who really cared about could really care about more easily than an interview show. And, you know, each thing that I've added to the network has been in that vein. I think with somebody like Dan Benjamin, I think what he's trying to do essentially is build enough audience so that he can sell his own advertising, because, you know, the advertising industry is not, you know, they're sort of like the radio industry, as far as I can tell. They're just not very responsive to the changes in the media landscape. And unfortunately, podcast advertising doesn't have the crazy huge advantage of web advertising, which is that you can track it click to sale, and you can just show someone a chart and say, you made this much money off of this advertisement, which is the basically the only thing that saved web advertisement from being ignored by people who are used to doing, you know, traditional media advertising. So, you know, you really gotta put together a pretty significant audience before you can sell to giant, you know, to Ford or whatever. If I called Ford right now, even with the network that I have, and said, you know, I've got, I don't know exactly how many listeners I have. This is my development director's department, but, you know, I've got 150,000 listeners across platforms every week. They would say, yeah, okay, call us back when that number is a million, because we're used to talking to television networks.
Right, right. Although you could argue that from a publisher's point of view, the sort of the inability to track that advertising outcome is sort of an advantage, because that was the advantage that television advertising and newspaper advertising had for so long. No one knew that it wasn't effective.
You know? Yeah, but there's competition, sadly. Nowadays, there's competition. I mean, I think that the thing that is difficult for us is to figure out ways to quantify for advertisers the connection that people have with podcasts, because it's very different from the connection that people have with traditional media. I mean, I watch American Pickers, for example, on the Discovery Channel, and I don't buy things because they're advertised on American Pickers. But I can tell you that the people who listen to my shows buy things because they're supporting my shows. And that's a very different relationship. There's a big difference between getting in front of eyeballs and having a connection to something that people have a real connection to. You know, it's the reason why they Fox is selling you the Coca-Cola American Idol show.
The last time we talked, the Sound of Young America was on a couple dozen radio stations, somewhere public radio stations, somewhere around there, and you'd said that in total you got about $10,000 a year from radio stations, and that the clear majority of your income from your projects was coming from donations. Is that ratio still about the same? Has radio become more or less important to you as a distribution method?
Well, the good news is that I think if I was getting about $10,000 a year before, I have doubled my radio revenue somehow.
Congratulations.
I think it's for maybe less than $20,000 a year, but right around there. But yeah, I think the proportion of our income has stayed the same or maybe even gone down. It's a pretty modest percentage of my total income. And public radio people are constantly, like, I have these conversations with public radio people, and they say, like, well, you know, Terry Gross is going to retire, and Diane Rehm is going to retire, and Garrison Keillor is going to retire, and they're going to need a show with a proven track record to fill in. And I'm like, you know, Terry Gross is only like 50, you know, like, I don't, she's not 73. She, and it's not as though she works at the sawmill, where she has to retire because of her aches and pains.
No black lung risk at NPR.
Yeah, like Perry Gross is pretty much still at the top of her game. I don't think there's any imminent risk that she's going to retire. I don't have any reason to feel like all of that is going to change in one big cataclysmic event, and all of a sudden my income is going to switch over to being mostly from the radio.
It is strange to think. You think of radio as being a very atomized world. You know, different. You know, you've got a different station in every market. Sometimes multiple stations in larger markets. You would think that would create a diversity of opportunities, but for the kinds of things that you know we're talking about, you know, they're like six people who have those jobs, and they're not all going to die soon.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. God bless them. I mean, they're successful and they do a great job. I have hardly a bad word to say about Terry Gross or Ira Glass or Robert Siegel. I think they're all totally brilliant. So God bless them.
Yeah. So you mentioned Max Funcon. We'll come back to that a little bit, but I know that your sponsorships of some sort. I don't know if that was as prominent or as you were doing that 2 years ago when we talked last, like the Ask Metafilter, for example. Is that sponsorship semi-advertising model something that you're looking towards to as a bigger piece of the pie?
Basically, we do two different things. We do, on the Sound of Young America, a very traditional public radio underwriting thing, and that's the Ask Metafilter thing, and we've done this with other companies as well, which is essentially a company pays some money to support the show, and we thank them on the air within some sort of specific FCC guidelines, and we follow those FCC guidelines both online and on broadcast, even though you're only legally required to do it on the air. For example, This American Life has been running just straight up advertisements in their podcast. And again, God bless him. Best show in the world. Now, we've also done some more advertising-y type stuff on our other shows, which I kind of see as having a different tone and a little bit more. It's a little bit more appropriate. The main thing that we've done, frankly, is this thing that we sort of call the Jumbotron style sponsorship, which is if you go to the baseball game, you can pay like $200 and you can have the your kid's birthday broadcast on the Jumbotron. So we do that on the non-Sound of Young America shows. So if a listener is there and they want to wish somebody a happy birthday or a happy anniversary or whatever, or they just want us to, you know, swear at their friend, we'll take $100 and do that. Just because it feels like it's in the spirit of the community and so on and so forth. And we also, for a little bit of extra money, we'll do that for just a business, you know, somebody's web comic or podcast or something like that. We've also, to some extent, pursued more traditional sponsor relationships, but it's not our priority, I would say. I mean, we've done some of it, I think, frankly. What a lot of companies are looking at online is they want to do branded content. They want to not disclose that they're paying for something. all these things that we just say, you know, we don't need to do that. Our listeners are supporting what we're doing. So, you know, there have been things that we've pursued. At one point we did pitch, at the invitation of a snack food company, we did pitch the idea of filling a swimming pool with a certain cheesy snack item and jumping into it and swimming it around for a web video. But that was mostly because we thought that was a great idea that we probably ought to do anyway.
Although you could argue that would actually be better as audio. I could see that just well, the mental images.
You could argue that in the sense that nobody wants to see me and Jordan in a swimsuit.
That's a driveway moment. All right. Well, the last time that we were talking, you were getting ready to host the first Max FunCon, which can you explain a little bit for those who aren't familiar with it, what it is and who are the kinds of people who attend?
Yeah, it's a conference. I usually say con is short for convocation. But it's sort of halfway between like a creativity, you know, writer's retreat type conference and a theme vacation. So it's in this mountain resort here in Southern California that's owned by UCLA. And it's up in the mountains, and it's in this kind of, it's like a former hunting lodge. So it's real, you know, Abraham Lincoln-y. And, well, it's more Teddy Roosevelt-y. And we have, during the day, there are like classes, like crafting classes, improv classes, that kind of thing. And then at night, there are big blowout comedy shows. So we have kind of hand-picked national headlining comedians performing at night. And then during the day, people are making themselves better through inspirational talks and learning how to make God's eyes.
So it's really a new religion that you founded.
Yeah, and it's only a couple hundred people. It's a very intimate event. It's a very intimate event in more than one sense, from what I've heard. I'm married. but it's a couple hundred people, and they all pay a pretty significant amount of money because this thing is really expensive to put on, especially because the ratio of people that are there to like perform and present and stuff to people who are paying to be there, it's like 3-1 or something like that. This is something that this kind of intimate experience is not something that scales into Comic-Con easily. So yeah, it's kind of expensive. So this is people who are really passionate about the stuff that we do, and they come not just to like hang out with John Hodgman or, you know, Jad Abumrad or whatever, but also to hang out with each other. So many of them are pals from the internet throughout the year, and it's kind of like the MaximumFun.org family reunion.
Mm-hmm. And how has the experience of putting that on for now, I guess, two cycles now, how has that varied from what you were anticipating? When we spoke, you were a little bit hesitant. You weren't quite sure how it was going to come off.
It's come off so well, so distressingly well. And I'm not bragging. I don't think it was my doing that made it so well. I think the thing that I didn't, that I maybe I hoped for, but I certainly didn't expect that happened, was, I think, given the work that we do, I think given the sort of values of MaximumFun.org, the people that come out to this thing are so bright and interesting and happy and like ready to make friends with each other that, and it was like this from the absolute first moment of the first Max FunCon. People just were immediately ready to make new best friends. Like it was a summer camp that they were coming back to for their seventh year. And that part was something that I don't know that I could have anticipated. And it totally defined the nature of the event and made me feel really proud to be a part of it, much less to have created it. So now, I mean, this year's Max FunCon is coming up in June, and it sold out before New Year's Day. And you know, we've thought about, I may at some point, you know, put on a Max FunCon East in addition to the one in Los Angeles or something like that. But and you know, all the folks that I invite to come to Max FunCon, they all say yes. So it's a totally, it's just been absolutely transformative for me. And, you know, when you run something that's based on donations, everything that you do is about making a significant connection with people, you know, whatever your operation is that's run by donations. And this connection is so profound. I mean, it's really amazing. People, you know, last year, some people planned their honeymoon around Max FunCon. It's really a remarkable thing. And it's very, you know, I feel like it has all of the good things about, say, Comic-Con with none of the bad things, like none of the creepy commercial alienation, or, you know, PAX, one of these big, cons that people go to. It's none of the creepy commercial alienation, none of the smelliness, but all of the kind of, the sense of everyone being on the same page.
Right. It seems like the kind of connection that you've made with the people who listen to your work and follow what you do is so strong that it obviously has benefits like what you were just describing, but it also seems like something that you might be a little bit scared of screwing up somehow, because it's not a business model where, you know, you sell cable and you know if people want the internet, then they're going to have to pay you $60 a month or whatever. It is all based on the personal connection you've made with people. And do you worry about if you know, one day doing something with a snack chip concern that alienates your listeners? Does it feel in any way fragile or yeah?
You know, I think I feel like the bonds are really solid, and I think that especially a lot of the shows that we've added to the family, so to speak, are shows that are more like Jordan Jesse Go than The Sound of Young America. And that may not be what it's like forever, but, you know, Stop Podcasting Yourself and My Brother and Me, which are the two shows that we've added to the network that I am not involved in the production of, are both very kind of humane, personal shows. And I think that when people, you know, when people see you from that perspective, they can understand why you're doing the things that you're doing. It's not like the relationship that people have with, I think maybe a good example might be Prince. Like Prince is a guy, I love Prince for one thing. I'm not putting down Prince. He's one of my favorites of all time, but he's a guy who people are incredibly devoted to based on this artistic output that is about three steps separated from who he actually is. And so sometimes when he does something crazy, which he often does, it's personally alienating to them. And I think that, you know, Jordan Jesse Go, I mean, it's me and Jordan talking mostly about the parts of our lives that are funny. So, you know, there's stuff that's left out, but it is us being us. And so people have a pretty good sense of what kind of people we are. And, you know, I think they understand why we make the decisions that we make. And I think the other thing is that, you know, it's definitely important to me that while I'm sort of the boss of MaximumFun.org, I'm not the only reason that people are into it, you know? There's plenty of people who are supporting our pledge drive right now who are not listeners to The Sound of Young America or Jordan Jesse Go. You know, they may be their listeners to My Brother and Me, which just joined the network a couple months ago, or Stop Podcasting Yourself. Or maybe they're listeners to the Judge John Hodgman podcast, which I am the bailiff, so I have a pretty modest role in the whole operation. And I think it's more about it's like I mentioned with Max FunCon, it's more about the community, which I certainly set the tone for, but it's more about the community than it is about a cult of personality around me, which, you know, I'm not that interested in doing that. And it seems like a real hassle and kind of a bummer and not a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the Sound of Young America, your first show, started off as a college radio show and has evolved in a radio direction and a podcast direction and all the other things we've discussed. It seems like the Maximum Fun endeavor seems to be on pretty solid ground. This seems like something that's gonna work out. And I say that as someone just watching from afar. As someone who watches the world of public radio and the kinds of people who are interested in being involved in public radio, whether that's as hosts or as reporters or whatever, does your experience and your observation give you the idea that there are going to be more people who might have gone a public radio, more traditional route 15 years ago, 20 years ago, who today are instead going to start building their own separate brands and their own separate operations and trying to build up the kind of loyalty and audience relationship that you've been talking about?
You know, I was talking to Ira Glass and he was telling me about how Thud, that was the sound of that name drop. He was telling me like they get like thousands of internship applications. And I think that a lot of people want to get into public radio, but their idea of like the only way to do it is to just intern at This American Life. Like that's pretty much where it begins and ends. And you know, that's great. This American Life is awesome. But I do think that this opens up the opportunity for people to get good at making content, without having to, be on the radio. And I think specifically in a public radio context, as a public radio host myself, I think that one limitation of the talent development stream, well, two limitations of the talent development stream in public radio that led to problems for public radio, I think, were number one, Because nobody had any money, everybody has to get in by not just unpaid internships, but often literally years of not full-time employment, which basically excludes everyone who isn't, you know, central middle class to upper middle class and above. So that's one problem. It's a big problem because you lose a lot of talent that way and because you obviously lose a lot of diversity that way. And then the secondary issue is that the only lower level on microphone jobs in public radio are essentially as reporters. So you lose the ability to develop talent that is outside of that talent pool. So, you know, Peter Sagal, for example, who's one of the biggest stars in public radio, if he hadn't been plucked out of his career as a playwright or whatever by Tori Malatia and Doug Berman or whoever it is that chose him to host Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, he would never have had the opportunity to develop his talent as a host, which he is an exceptionally talented host. Or Garrison Keillor, you know, there's no way to develop another Garrison Keillor unless that next Garrison Keillor is right now working as a reporter and really loves journalism in addition to spinning tall tales. And so those are big problems for talent development for public radio. And those are, I think, in part addressed by the availability of podcasting. And also, you know, I think that was why, for example, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funded this thing called the Public Radio Talent Quest that led to, among other things, this great show called Snap Judgment out of Oakland that this guy Glenn Washington hosts. And Glenn was like running a small nonprofit and he had no interest in being a journalist. He was a part-time professional storyteller. And now he's hosting a public radio show because, you know, public radio realized, oh my gosh, the only people that we have as talent are people who make long form audio documentaries, about the sound of leaves crunching under boot heels or are reporters. And no disrespect to either of those groups, because obviously, you know, some people, you know, Jad Abumrad, who hosts Radiolab, came through that world, and he's about as brilliant and spectacular a radio producer as could exist. But you miss out on a lot of possible Peter Sagals, for example, by running things that way.
Are you seeing, you mentioned the thousands of people who are still applying for This American Life. Are you seeing young people who are, you know, are people contacting you and saying, hi, I'm 22. I'm interested. I listen to lots of radio. I'm interested in this. Can I get an internship with The Sound of Young America? Or can you tell me how to do this? Is that, are you in that, do you get that kind of mail and that kind of contact?
Yeah. Say hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
My intern, Lindsay. I guess that's an answer.
She goes to Occidental here, but, you know, other people, in fact, there's a girl who works at a young woman who works at Snap Judgment, Glenn Washington's show. And, you know, she was a listener to The Sound of Young America and Jordan Jesse Go and emailed me and said, I live in the Bay Area, so I can't come work for you. But how can I get into public radio? And I told her some people who were working on shows in San Francisco and said, just get in touch with these people and tell them that you want to do something. And they did. And now it's basically on. As far as whether public radio has started to dip into that talent base, everything in public radio moves at a really slow pace, so we'll see how that happens, that podcasting talent base. We'll see how that happens. I am with my friend Nick actually producing a public radio version of Mark Maron's show, WTF, that is going to be on public radio stations in the, I guess you would say, late spring of this year, and that's really exciting. But, you know, we'll see in the long term how it affects things. But I can't imagine that it won't. I mean, I can't imagine that people like, you know, the guys who host the Dinner Party Download who work for American Public Media. I mean, they've gone from a short segment on a local show to a short segment on a national show to essentially their own show, basically through the success of their podcast.
What you need to do is create a podcast-centric version of that comic book that Ira Glass and This American Life put together a few years ago, Radio. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I not only do I remember that, I literally have a stack of, it's called Radio and Illustrated Guide. I have a stack of copies of it here in my office that I send to people all the time. Mm. And it's how I actually got into audio production. I bought that comic book and learned how to edit audio on my, I don't know, I will probably my Pentium, maybe a 486 laptop.
PC Junior.
When I was in college. Yeah. And yeah, it was a PC XT. And a tape deck that I borrowed from my mom that was one of those early tape recorder decks that was the size of the receiver in your home stereo, but had a shoulder strap like you were going to carry it around. Right. So I did actually carry it around. Yeah.
Nice. Well, let me switch gears a little bit to talk a little about Put This On. And we're talking about various funding models, and the beginning of Put This On was a funding model that has gained some stature in the last year or so. It was a Kickstarter project. Can you talk a little bit about the idea behind that? What led you to want to go in that direction, as in terms of a topic, and as a project, and also you know, how did you find the Kickstarter experience?
Kickstarter, if anybody doesn't know, is this website where you post a creative project and then people pledge a donation towards it, and they only have to pay if your goal is met. And if your goal is met, you're obliged to make the thing. So I've always been really interested in men's style. I have a shelf in my home library dedicated to books on the subject. I'm a real men's style geek. And I always wanted to do something around that because I figured, you know, one of the things that makes one a success in broadcasting is often having an expertise. I mean, look at Dr. Phil, right? and that was something that I actually legitimately had some expertise in, but it wasn't really suitable to radio because it's so visual. And I don't have amazing video skills. In fact, I don't even have amazing audio skills. I really have the bare minimum competence in audio that I developed just so that I could make something. So I made friends with this guy, Adam Lissagore, who at the time I knew primarily because he was good friends with my friend Scott Simpson and Merlin Mann, who do this amazing comedy podcast called You Look Nice Today. And Scott and Merlin live up in the Bay Area, but Adam lives down here in Los Angeles. So I was like, man, I should make friends with this guy. And we both had dogs, so we started hanging out at the dog park together. And I was like, man, this guy is really cool. And he turned out to be kind of a video genius. He produced a pledge drive video for me that was so beautiful and amazing. It was like the difference. I think it probably increased my pledge donations 30% that year. And he had just sort of struck out on his own. He had been working as an editor and After Effects guy for commercials mostly, some films. He operated the Predator cam in Alien versus Predator 2.
Wow.
But mostly editing and stuff. And he had struck out on his own, and I was like, hey, Adam, do you want to do a video series with me? And he's like, yeah, of course. And so I said, well, it's about men's style. It's going to be blah, 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 blah. And he's like, yep, I'm in. And I said, and I think we should try and make money from it. And he said, yep, absolutely, because he didn't have any work at the time. So Kickstarter was the first thing that came to mind. I knew some people that worked at Kickstarter and had described it to me, and I thought, wow, that sounds really cool. Nothing in the MaximumFun.org world was sufficiently, I guess you would say, project-oriented to work with Kickstarter. We weren't like putting out an album and needed money for the recording studio or something, which is the kind of project thing that worked really well on Kickstarter. But we were like, well, what is the least amount of money we could get paid to make this, to make a pilot for this that would still make us feel like we were actually getting paid and it wasn't baloney? We decided on $1,500. $500 for me to host it, $500 for Adam to direct it, and $500 for him to edit it. And we raised that money really quickly. And then we made a video and people loved it. And we were like, wow, we should make some more. So we planned out a six episode first season and set a fundraising target and again, we raised it really quickly. And along the way, between those two things, I had sort of started blogging around just sort of between episodes to kind of keep people plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be just extraordinarily successful, at least by my standards. I can't speak to whether it was artistically or informationally, educationally successful, but definitely in terms of traffic, the traffic to put this on started basically within 3 or 4 months. I was doing more traffic on Put This On than on MaximumFun.org. And so I was like, wow, this is great. And also I was having a lot of fun. And so now we're essentially at this point. It's about, I don't know, 18 months since we started. We've got 3 episodes left in season 1, and they're all shot. They're coming out middle of March, middle of April, and middle of May. And then we're going to decide where we go from there. I mean, the big change is that Adam, in the meantime, America has recognized his genius.
True.
And he's come to be very successful as a maker of web videos, working for some big technology companies and so on.
Flipboard video and the Square video and a variety of others that our listeners might recognize him from.
Recently, a totally amazing 3D video on YouTube for Jawbone, which people should really check out. It's so cool. Like you watch it in 3D by doing that magic eye thing. Unless you have a 3D monitor. If you have a 3D monitor, you can just watch it in 3D. I didn't even know that YouTube did 3D. But the fact that it does this crazy kind of magic eye 3D totally blew my mind. But anyway, he's become extraordinarily successful. So over the past few months, we've had to figure out how to work this around his crazy schedule in addition to mine. But yeah, it's become this huge thing. And I don't know where exactly it'll end up going, but it's really fun to me. So I'm still doing it.
Yeah. I'm interested in how you approach the ads that are the sponsorships. I'm not sure exactly what phrasing you use, but the commercial messages, shall we say, in the most recent one, the one that was shot in a manner that was, it reminded me a little bit of Johnny Carson, you know, in a break of the Tonight Show, pulling out a Budweiser and saying, you know, drink a Bud, sort of embedding the host experience into an advertising experience.
Yeah, I mean, part of the deal, we've had a few advertisers on Put This On that have mostly sought us out rather than the other way around. And part of the deal is basically, we'll make the ad for you. Because it just makes more sense for us. I mean, it works in the flow of the show better. People want to watch it because it's still stuff that we made and they like us. And you know, all our ads have been for people that we liked. So our ads, I mean, all our ads are post-roll, at least to this point. We may put ads in other places, but I'm very sensitive to the user's experience, so we're trying to make it pleasant for the user. And because they're post-roll, we want something that people will actually enjoy watching and want to watch. So if we make that, then we have control over it.
Right, right. Well, you said we'll see what happens after the initial funding and the season ends. What are some of the possibilities that you might be thinking of? Is it at a point where you think it might be self-sustaining and worth your time to do that? Is it, you know, taking it to another medium? What are the possibilities?
Yeah, I mean, those are the possibilities. Essentially, it's an open question right now. Often when we talk with... I have not sold a lot of advertising in my time. My experience with the little bit of fashion advertising that I've sold is that often people want an advertising package that we're not comfortable putting together. And that often means some form of non-disclosed branded content. or disclosed branded content, but that is presented as being editorial content.
Right. And that's particularly for you, since so much of the blog, at least, is, you know, recommending specific brands, specific items. It would be very easy for that to be perceived as tainted if, you know, it was paid for.
Yeah, and, you know, there are plenty of people who... there was just that big article in the New York Times Magazine about mommy bloggers doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fraught territory for me that I feel like we need to be really, really careful about. Because, I mean, among other things, it's just not fun to me, you know, to heck with it. I'm totally willing to make branded content for a brand that I like, but I am pretty uncomfortable with making branded content and then presenting it as editorial content. And I think maybe because of the relationship between fashion brands and fashion magazines, which has always been a little bit closer than between, say, the advertisers of the Economist and the editorial staff of the Economist. That's an expectation from some people. And so I don't know. I mean, we have had some really awesome advertisers. I mean, like, for example, shirt.woot.com came to us and they said, "We really like Put This On. How much would it cost you to make it? Cost to have you guys make an ad for us?" And we said, it would cost X amount of money. And also, you should know that we'll probably a little bit make fun of the fact that we're doing an ad for shirt.woot.com. And they said, "Yes, we were hoping that you would make fun of the fact that you were doing an ad for shirt.woot.com." And so when you have an advertiser like that, it's like, great. They said, do whatever you want. I'm sure it'll be great. And we totally did something and it totally was great. Or Instapaper was another one where the guy who invented Instapaper emailed us and said, "I love Put This On. How can I support it? I think an ad for Instapaper would be perfect. Do whatever you want." We talked with him a little bit about it and made something that was totally awesome and I think brought him a lot of people, a lot of users. So that's great. But on the other hand, so far that has not really been so much money that it would sustain what we're doing. And also, if we had to do the sales of that, that is such a bummer. I mean, part of the biggest reason why I'm doing Put This On is because it's fun. And selling advertising is not fun. And I don't really want to be an ad sales guy. So we're definitely thinking about continuing with user sponsorship for season two. We've also, I mean, I posted something on the blog, "How do you think we should fund season two?" And I got, you know, dozens of emails from people saying, "I want to send you money so you can make it."
Hmm.
I don't know if that's how we're going to do it. We're going to talk about it and think about it over the next couple months. We have a couple months to decide, and we definitely want to make more, and we'll see how it goes. We have had some interest from traditional media about doing something with Put This On. I kind of sort of recently got offered a job as like the editorial guy for the web for Esquire.
Wow.
Which I had to explain to them. They asked me if I had a resume. And I had to explain to them that no, because I host a nationally syndicated radio show and a television program, and I haven't applied for a job in like 5 years. And they were like, "Oh, okay, because we were thinking of inviting you to be the blah, blah, blah." And I was like, "Yeah, I kind of have 7 jobs.
You're not just some blogger in your spare time. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we've had some television interest as well. I don't know if we are 100% certain about how what we do would translate to television, because I don't think what we're doing right now would make, for example, a makeover show, which is probably the main established format in our genre. I mean, we could probably do a makeover show, but it would be different, pretty different from what we're doing right now. So when we've talked to TV people, we've sort of been of the position that, hey, we're going to finish season one and see where we're at. rather than starting in on a makeover show right now.
There's room for another Clinton Kelly in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against makeover shows. It's just not my priority at the moment. So, you know, we're sort of evaluating what the next steps are. And for me, this is basically the guiding principle. I need to make a certain amount of money to support myself and support my family. My wife works with me now, so we need to make a certain amount of money to support our family. And my wife's pregnant, so there's going to be a baby. I sort of grew up one step above poor. I don't think that my family ever, you know, there was no time when there was no food. But, you know, I definitely paid for doctor visits with stickers from the state of California. And I kind of don't really feel a burning desire to be rich or like as rich as I can. Mm-hmm. And so my real priority is, as long as I'm making enough money to support myself and my family and, you know, save for retirement and, you know, I don't know about buy a house. I live in Los Angeles. That may be hopeless, but, you know, those other things, have health insurance. Then my real priority is doing the things that I think are fun and cool.
Right.
So that I'm not a sad person. I think that will make my family happier and my kids happier and so on and so forth. So, when I evaluate what work I want to do and what I want to pursue, it's not just driven by the market. Although that's part of the equation, it's driven by what I want to do. And I mean, for example, when I bring a podcast into MaximumFun.org, I certainly hope that the extra revenue that they bring in through donations is going to support the money that I'm sending them. But part of why I'm doing it is because I like that if there's a podcast I like, I can send them money so that they're earning money to do it.
Right.
I can feel really proud about that. And as an entrepreneur, I know that makes me a sort of B-minus entrepreneur in a funny way, but hopefully it makes me a happier person.
Last thing I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned earlier the television show that the Grid on IFC, 7:45 on Thursdays.
Yes.
I have to say, whenever I first saw 7:45, it made me think it was like the Texaco theater hour. Like, you don't see too many time slots at 15 minutes before the hour. Talk a little bit about how that came into being and how you ended up connecting with IFC on that. And I guess more broadly, maybe to wrap things up, as you've shifted from a guy with a college radio show into this podcasting network and now into this very successful web video project and now television, I guess I just want to get you to think about this sounds horrible, but what is the Jesse Thorne brand? You know, what is it that do you consciously think about how each of these pieces of the puzzle sort of add up into something whole, since you are really selling this personal connection? I mean, you're not selling it. That's putting an artificial capitalist business model-y kind of approach on top of it. But, you know, that is a big part of what you're doing. I guess, how does it all fit together?
Yeah. Well, let me start with the first part, which is how the Grid came around. Essentially, I've had sort of a very casual relationship with some folks at IFC. A casual relationship. Friends with benefits.
It's Hollywood.
Let's call it. We go to the same key parties. There are some folks at IFC that have been fans of The Sound of Young America for a really long time. You know, they listen to it on WNYC in New York and get the podcast, and they just thought it was cool. And so they started doing a lot more original programming about a year ago. They have sort of broadened their brand from just showing movies to adding a lot of comedy content, like Fred Armisen and Kerry Brownstein's show Portlandia and Onion Network News, both of which are just stunningly hilarious and basically reruns of every favorite show of mine of all time, like Mr. Show and Larry Sanders, Freaks and Geeks, basically everything I love. Undeclared, I think, maybe not Freaks and Geeks. So they were expanding in this direction, and they were also expanding production here in LA. And their producer here in LA, Michael Pressman, was putting together this show, The Grid, which is It's kind of like, I think your audience would probably understand if I described it as kind of like a television, a more culture-oriented television version of Boing Boing. Like, it's sort of like a show that's a trip around the coolest things going on in culture right now, coolest, most remarkable things, with a little bit of a geeky shade to it. And I contributed to the pilot a piece that was Put This On inspired about Blue Jeans. And it was the first time I'd ever like worked with a teleprompter or anything. And so I did that piece. And they brought me back 6 months later, or whenever they picked up the show, to do another piece as Jesse Thorne, viral video expert. And then the host of the show had some opportunities. He's in this guy, Alex Berg, who's in this amazing, just totally amazing improv group here in Los Angeles. And they just had some cool opportunities coming along. He just couldn't do the show anymore. And they said, "Hey, Jesse, do you want to host this show?" And I didn't expect that. I don't even have a manager or an agent. I had to call a friend and ask for a referral to his lawyer to negotiate my contract. But I did it because I like the show. And because I really like the people that work on the show. I mean, it's just, you've probably never had occasion to spend a lot of time with TV people, but they tend to be pretty unctuous. And the people that work on this show are all really, really nice and like not creepy, and bright and funny. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. And, you know, Jordan, my co-host on Jordan Jesse Go, also works on the show. And it's just a really cool, fun thing. And it's neat to host a television show. I mean, it wasn't like my ambition. It was something I was always interested in doing, but it wasn't what I was like building towards. It's just something that came along and is great. It's fun. Now, as far as what the Jesse Thorne brand is, I mean, I think maybe I got to know it a little bit when I did the first Max FunCon. I think that the brand of, if not Jesse Thorne, at least Maximum Fun, which is the thing that I think about the most in terms of branding, is about people that are passionate about the world around them and passionate about especially fun and humor, and aren't afraid to be smart or passionate. And the combination of smart and passionate is often interpreted as geeky. But, you know, I don't really think of myself as a geek, and which is nothing to say, nothing negative about those who do. But I just think that it's built around that idea of being passionate about fun and thinking and culture and, you know, expressing it and about things that are good. You know, the original slogan of The Sound of Young America was a public radio show about things that are awesome. And something that I've always tried to do on The Sound of Young America is, you know, I don't really, I think there's this world of kind of, I'm a pop culture junkie that is really into like Jersey Shore or whatever. And I feel strongly that just because we're going to erase the lines between high and low culture doesn't mean we should erase the lines between things that are good and things that aren't. And so I think 30 Rock or Archer, you know, Archer's a better example because Archer's really vulgar and silly. Archer fits in just as well as, you know, Masterpiece on PBS. If it's a good Masterpiece, I mean, I think a lot of Masterpieces at this point are a little bit boring, but I think we can both agree that Downton Abbey was pretty awesome.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's... Does that make sense to you? I feel like I'm rambling into nonsensicality, but...
Well, I'm asking you to define your basic essence. So, you know, it's not an easy question in a lot of ways.
I mean...
There's also a personal brand, and then there's the Maximum Fun brand. And to a certain degree, those are the same. But also, as you bring in more shows, and as more people come to that brand without maybe interacting with you, or maybe they interact with it primarily through John Hodgman, or maybe they interact with you by watching on IFC, but don't listen to anything that you do in an audio world. You know, the branding issues start to get a little bit more diffuse, I would think. There are probably lots of people who know you as a guy who likes to talk about clothes and nothing else.
Yeah, you know, I've gotten recognized on the street twice in the last 2 days, both times in thrift stores, by people who recognize me from Put This On, which was totally new to me. I guess that's true. Ultimately, I think my saving grace is that because I have this business of MaximumFun.org that is successful enough that I can support myself and I don't have to worry. And I don't have to worry that somebody's going to cancel it because it's mine. Then I can mostly just do things that I am interested in. And so... I don't have to do something that is false to me, and I can let my guiding light be, do I like this and think it's worth doing?
Mm-hmm.
And that way, if somebody says, you know, why are you doing an advertisement for t-shirts on Put This On, I can say, well, because they were really nice and they said we could kind of make fun of them. And I think the t-shirts are a perfectly appropriate thing to wear when you're cleaning your yard. and so I can always have my actual honest feelings to fall back on. And so whenever I need to gut check, I don't need to gut check against some mind map I've made of what the brand is. I can just gut check against what I actually think.
Right. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.